Nous reprenons les activités du séminaire Eridia aujourd'hui avec une communication de notre collègue Armel Paré. Armel est maître de conférence à l'université de Caen depuis le début des années 2000. L'intervention d'Armel aujourd'hui porte sur la maladie d'Alzheimer dans la fiction anglophone, Alzheimer's Victims in Fiction. Merci à toi, Armel, d'avoir accepté d'intervenir dans le cadre de ce séminaire. Je te laisse la parole. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Okay, so hello or hello again to some of you. Maybe I'll start with giving you a handout. It's just the list of words that I'll be mentioning, okay? Okay? So, in his introduction to a book called Representations of Illness in Film and Literature, Lenny Kravitz points out the idea of incorporating disease or illness in literature has been with us from the beginning of fiction writing. Take, for example, the concept of madness. There have always been narrative strands of madness dating from the works of Homer, Cervantes, and Shakespeare. Representations of illness have captured the imaginations of countless readers. In addition, Kravitz notes the appearance of new diseases and their entrance into fiction. Such is the case of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia, diseases that challenge the normal functioning of the brain. Alzheimer's disease, also called AD, as you probably know, is a degenerative brain disease of unknown cause that is the most common form of dementia that usually starts in late middle age or in old age and that results in progressive memory loss, impaired thinking, disorientation, and changes in personality and mood. Yet, in a number of texts, these characters with AD, and AD itself are only side elements in the plot. For instance, Alice Munro, the Canadian writer who was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2013, Alice Munro wrote a story entitled The Bear Came Over the Mountain, which was published in the New Yorker, in the New Yorker in 1999. And in this story, this story features a female character, Fiona, married to Grant, and Fiona is in the grip of Alzheimer's disease. And we have just a short extract here. Over a year ago, Grant had started noticing so many little yellow notes stuck up all over the house, stuck onto the kitchen drawers, cutlery, dish towels, knives. Couldn't she just open the drawers and see what was inside? Worse things were coming. She went to town and phoned Grant from a booth to ask him how to drive home. One recognizes here behavioral patterns and events linked to Alzheimer's disease. However, as you can see from the quote, notably with the question that is, in fact, Grant's, the narrative is actually told with Grant, with the husband as a focalizer. The story is, in fact, about love, aging, and institutional care. As for the disease, it's mostly about its effect on the patient's husband, such as his own his own sense of estrangement, rather than about the feelings of the diseased Fiona herself, whose thoughts we do not have access to. So that was my first example. My second example is taken from Ian McEwan's Atonement, published in 2001. And at the very end of the novel, the main character is diagnosed with vascular dementia. The disease is significant in the novel because the protagonist is burdened by the memory of a crime. Okay, the memory of a crime. And she's burdened also by her attempt at making up for this crime through her writing. So, and the prospect of forgetting eventually brings the character to put a final point to a narrative she has been drafting all her life. So here's a quote. "The process will be slow, but my brain, my mind is closing down. The little failures of memory that dog us all beyond a certain point will become more noticeable, more debilitating, until the time will come when I won't notice them because I will have lost the ability to understand anything at all. The days of the week, the events of the morning, or even 10 minutes ago will be beyond my reach. My phone number, my address, my name, and what I did with my life will all be gone. Here, we seem to have an insider's view, as this is a first-person narrative, and the narrator is the one who is affected with the narrative. But the narrative, however poignant, only foretells the development of the disease. The disease is yet to develop, and it remains accessory to the plot. In his next novel, Saturday, that was published in 2005, McEwan also had a protagonist with some form of dementia. Saturday is focuses around one character, Henry Peroni, the day in the life of this neurosurgeon. Okay, and this character's mother suffers from some form of dementia. Lily's condition, Lily's the name of the character, her condition is at a later stage as she lives in a home. And the depiction of her state is developed over several pages. And again, I just have a quick quote here. His mother is watching him closely, pleased and anxious all at once. She thinks she knows his face. He might be the doctor or the odd job man. She's waiting for a cue. He kneels by her chair and takes her hand, which is smooth and dry and very light. Hello, Mum, Lily. It's Henry, your son Henry. Hello, darling, where are you going? I've come to see you. We'll go and sit in your room. I'm sorry, dear, I don't have a room. I'm waiting to go home. I'm getting the bus. It pains him whenever she says that, even though he knows she's referring to her childhood home where she thinks her mother is waiting for her. The dialogue gives the diseased Lily a voice, but the narrative is otherwise mostly focused on her son's point of view, and it conveys its own dismay rather than her own. I could add another example would be outside Anglophone fiction. It's the last Wallander novel, if you're familiar with this detective hero. The last Wallander novel ends with the detective's descent into oblivion, which is an explanation for the sudden blanks in the course of the story. Anyway, all these are novels that mention Alzheimer's disease and include it in their plots. But there are a few novels that make Alzheimer's disease or dementia the actual thematic center of the novel. And these novels try to convey the viewpoint of the patient. And such is the case of these two, Still Alice by Lisa Genova, published in 2007, and of Emma Healy's Elizabeth is Missing, published in 2014. These novels diverge in genre and narrative technique, as well as in their approach to the topic. First, if I start with Genova's novel, Genova herself has a PhD in neuroscience from Harvard University, which gives her the ability to be very precise in the documentation of the disease. Her novel is preceded by acknowledgements that thank a large number of medical specialists as well. Still Alice is divided into chapters, each devoted to a month, starting when the protagonist, Alice, first notices signs of disturbance and is then diagnosed. It goes on to chart the development of the disease over a year. This is a third-person narrative that exposes Alice's point of view and is entirely focused on the development of the disease and how it affects the character and her family. Alice is educated, she's a professor in linguistics, and her husband is a scientific researcher, which makes discussions and detailed explanations about the disease plausible in the narrative. The characters anticipate on what is going to happen. Part of the drama is Alice's awareness of how she is going to change. This actually offers a dual view on patients with AD. Both the experience of the disease is depicted and the reaction to it by others, because Alice herself experiences both. The character itself experiences both. As suggested by the title, Still Alice, the politics of the novel reside in the promotion of empowerment and not limitation of the diseased character. Conversely, Emma Healy's Elizabeth is Missing, about which I'm mostly going to talk today, does not address the issue of the disease directly, but uses it as an underlying context, all the better to convey the sense of forgetting. Elizabeth is Missing is a first-person narrative divided into 18 numbered chapters framed by a prologue and an epilogue. The homodiegetic narrator is Maud, aged 82. Maud struggling with her disappearing memory. At the beginning of the novel, because she has forgotten what has recently happened to her friend Elizabeth, and can just see in the present that, I quote, Elizabeth is missing, Maud starts an inquiry, convinced that something wrong has happened to her friend. It is a fact that people with Alzheimer's see their recent memory go before their long-term one. And Healy builds on this. As the protagonist battles on with her elusive recent past and present, she returns to a more distant past. In Maud's mind, this investigation combines with that of her sister's unexplained disappearance shortly after the Second World War. Of course, Maud is stalled in her double project of investigation because of her developing dementia. Both these novels were well received, they sold well. Originally, Still Alice was originally self-published, and it is a popular novel that went on to spend over 40 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Elizabeth is Missing also enjoyed critical success as the winner of the Costa First Novel Award in 2014. In fact, both these novels attest of the viewpoint noted by Benny Kravitz, which is the currently sympathetic, empathetic, and realistic viewpoint vis-à-vis illness projected today. Illness is not used as a metaphor, as it may have been in 19th century novels. These novels demonstrate a sincere attempt at describing what it feels to live with AD or a similar disease. In Elizabeth is Missing, Healy develops one particular character, but she reaches out beyond the individual because her novel conveys the sense, the experience of forgetting, both for Maud and her environment. Philippa Berry, who reviewed the novel for The Independent, was quite enthusiastic. Normally, a well-observed literary novel that accurately shows us ourselves by deepening our knowledge of what it is to be human cannot manage, as well, to be both a comedy and a thriller. Elizabeth is Missing, however, encompasses these genres and deserves prizes in all categories. I propose to examine the narrative and stylistic, strategies at work in Healy's novel to convey the point of view of the patient, to convey the process of memory loss and disorientation due to dementia, in order to deepen our knowledge of what it is to be human, to elicit sympathy and understanding from the reader. So that's what I intend to do. How will I do that? Healy's novel is remarkable for the unusual use of a character in the process of losing their memory to conduct an investigation. This paper first considers the use of conceits belonging to detective fiction in the novel before, that would be my second point, exploring the role and impact of the first-person narrator. And finally, I will try to establish if the detour of by detective fiction plus a reference to the historical past provide the means for a stabilizing closure. So first, borrowing from detective fiction. As I said, a major paradoxical aspect of the novel, of this novel, is to have a narrator affected by dementia in charge of solving a mystery. Of course, detection tends to have the past as its object, and the past is the very object that eludes someone with Alzheimer's. So it's worth examining how and to what extent the forgetting process and the investigating process combine. Healy's novel actually contains two overlapping mysteries. First, what happened to Elizabeth? And second, why and how did Maud's sister, called Suki, disappear 70 years earlier? So formally, the narrative has the duality of the classic detective novel, as described by Todorov in Typologie du roman policier. Talking about the whodunit, which is the classic form of detective fiction that was very popular between the two world wars, Todorov writes that it contains not one but two stories, the story of the crime and the story of the investigation. This duality is present in Elizabeth is Missing, with the story of the investigation when Maud tries to retrieve, mostly from memory, a past narrative, which is the story of the crime that took place earlier. Because Maud has Alzheimer's and elusive memories, her obsessive search for what recently happened to her friend merges with her search for her sister. The story of Suki's disappearance in 1946, its preceding period and its aftermath, all this forms a narrative that is not linear, but follows Maud's reminiscences that go back and forth in the past. For instance, chapter two mentions broken records found in the garden after the sister's disappearance. Chapter three goes back to Suki's last visit before disappearance, obviously, to her family, and then moves forwards to Maud and her father's investigation among the neighbors, and so on and so on. As for the story of the investigation, which is set in Maud's present, it is no classic investigation. We follow the questionings and inquiries of a woman in her 80s who is herself a dual character. She is both Holmes and Watson. She's both Poirot and Hastings. She is the detective, but because of her developing dementia, she also represents the ignorance necessary to detective fiction to convey and entertain suspense. Moreover, she appears as a parody of the figure of the detective when she makes inquiries and observations and draws conclusions, which she writes on little bits of paper so as not to forget. So Maud's quest is clearly impinged, slowed down by her deteriorating memory, but in some respects it's also activated by it. In fact, it appears that it is her dementia that entices Maud's movements from present to past. For instance, when she gets lost and does not recognize the way to the shop in the present one morning, it reminds her of the end of the war. In other words, the disorientation due to forgetting brings about memories. Besides, when her brain does not make the immediate connections between cause and effect, or is constantly in a world of interrogations and contradictions because of impaired thinking, Maud makes alternative interpretations. For instance, the pieces of a broken black plate elicit the memory of broken gramophone records after her sister's disappearance. The point here is that in showing the activity and relative agility of Maud's mind, Healy empowers her character with AD and contradicts the idea of helpless victim that others, notably her carer in the novel, reduce her to. As I said, the past is Maud's object of inquiry, and so the novel goes back and forth between past and present, and the switch to the past is usually clearly signposted by a blank or a space on the page. Also, the two stories are told, of past and present, investigation and crime. These two stories are told in different tenses. The present tense for Maud's current life and questions originally contrasts with the simple past for the narrative set after the Second World War. Maud's condition and a sense of immediacy are conveyed by the present tense, which establishes closer contact between Maud, her actions, and the reader. I just have one example here. I ring the bell. It echoes through the empty house. That's a quote. No? The phrase bubbles up from somewhere, but bells always echo through houses, surely, empty or not. I wait and work a hand deep into one of the earth-filled barrels by the front step. These are usually crammed with flowers, but not even a green shoot breaks the surface now. Elizabeth must have forgotten to plant any bulbs this year. I pull my hand out quickly. I can't think what I was doing in the soil. Was I just feeling for bulbs, or am I supposed to be looking for something else? The use of the present tense also adds to the sense of being cut off from the past. Maud now lives in the present only, since she does not remember her past actions. Because of her condition, her search for her friend Elizabeth and her search for her long-disappeared sisters merge. In fact, the elderly and sick Maud is puzzled by the situations she finds herself in today, just like the young Maud from the past, who did not fully understand what was going on with Suki, the madwoman, and so on. Having said all this, the neat distinction between past and present gradually collapses until the I in the present includes the I in the past too. Chapter 11 thus begins with, something's happened, I have to get up, get out, get to Suki. She then exclaims, surprised, I feel like an old woman. She is, of course. Mode's higher level of confusion is thus rendered with the merging of the two time frames, when she's now using the present tense to refer to events from the past, her sister. Mode, the character loses sense of the passing of time. There are consequently no precise time markers in her narrative, but we understand that time passes as Maud's condition deteriorates and she moves in with her daughter and granddaughter and her house is sold. It is these events that indicate the passing of time, not Maud's narrative that is stuck in an everlasting present. As a metaphor of this, her quest for Elizabeth stagnates. And indeed, the use of B plus via ing form or present progressive in the title, Elizabeth is missing, announces an ongoing and endless situation. It refers to both past, present, and future from Maud's perspective that is anchored in the present. Right, I move on to my second point. Elizabeth is Missing is a first-person narrative, as you've seen, okay? And this type of narrative can be considered as more authentic, or seeming more authentic. Here you have a quote from Consciousness and the Novel by David Lodge, and he talks about this type of first-person narrative. He admits that it is just as artful or artificial a method as writing about a character in the third person, but it creates an illusion of reality. It commands the willing suspension of the reader's disbelief by modeling itself on the discourses of personal witness, the confession, the diary, autobiography, etc. The sense of authenticity, the sense of proximity that first-person narrative entails, if Lodge is to be believed, this sense is partly challenged in Healy's novel. Indeed, the novel is made up of Maud's interior monologue. Okay, it's an interior monologue interrupted by dialogues with other characters. In fact, the narrative situation is not always clear, as we realize that some things that appear to be only in Maud's mind must in fact be said aloud because other characters react. Because it is an interior monologue and supposedly not meant for other eyes or ears, no information is given regarding time and place, unless it is in other characters' reported speech. There is no overall view of the situation, no overall view of the narrator. All we have is what the narrator says and what other characters remark. At first, Maud does not actually say she's forgetting things. Forgetting is not named nor commented upon. But via Maud's interior monologue, the reader is made to share her experience and puzzlement. For instance, when she interrupts her narrative and asks herself, "What was it I came for?" Made to observe forgetting, the reader realizes he or she is dealing with some sort of unreliable narrator. This type of narrator was first defined by Wayne C. Booth in The Rhetoric of Fiction in 1961. What do we mean by that? Generally speaking, the unreliable narrator is recognizable by the discrepancy between what is said by the narrator and what the implied author says. The the rise and development of the unreliable narrator throughout the history of fiction has been noted. One goes from unreliable narrator to incompetent ones. So I'm quoting here Brian Richardson from Unnatural Voices. One goes from unreliable narrators to incompetent ones to delusional and then completely insane storytellers. And Richardson remarks that unreliability has proliferated under postmodernism, but he understands it as only as anti-mimetic. And Elizabeth is Missing differs from this postmodern unreliability on two accounts. First, Healy's narrator precisely aims at being mimetic, at describing the real world and actual feelings. And second, the narrator is not trying to trick the reader by deliberately not saying everything she knows, as is the case most famously in The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie, or more recently Enderby by Sebastian Forbes. In fact, Maude is one of these victim types of unreliable narrators, like the narrator with Asperger's syndrome in The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Haddon, or like the child narrator in Room by Emma Donoghue. A narrator whose perspective is constricted by a life in captivity in the sole company of his mother. So in Richardson's terminology, Maude would be an incompetent narrator as she is impaired by her loss of memory and therefore unable to give a full and accurate account. However, looking at The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, Professor John Mullen suggests a different phrase, the phrase inadequate narrator. The inadequate narrator is not an established critical term, yet the more usual unreliable narrator seems inaccurate for a narrator who, however uncomprehending, is entirely trustworthy. We are not invited to be skeptical about what Christopher tells us. Christopher, being the equivalent of Maude, Christopher is the boy with Asperger's syndrome in the novel. Likewise, Maude is sincere, if struggling to describe her surroundings. Moreover, the words incompetent and inadequate suggest some insufficiency that Maude somewhat overrides when she eventually solves the mystery of her sister's disappearance, as we'll see later. Experience of disorientation and of the forgetting process is conveyed through internal focalization. And I suggest looking at an excerpt which narrates a sudden dispute, a sudden row with her daughter Helen. And this shows a moment of forgetting, a bout of forgetting. See, it starts with, I stamp on a glass and kick my alarm clock across the room. I close my eyes and shriek. Mom, stop it, what happened? Helen skirts around and puts her hand on my shoulders, but I throw her off and hit out, catching her in the stomach. Get out, I shout. I scream again and push over a chair. And then she's gone. And my alarm clock is broken. The wires exposed, the tiny cogs biting into the carpet. I must have dropped it. I'll have to tell Helen to get me a new one. There's a glass broken too. So here what you can see is highlighted in color. You can see the change from the active to the passive form. I stamp on a glass, there's a glass broken, to convey the narrator's complete disengagement with a situation she cannot explain, but a situation she can infer, as suggested by the modal must in I must have dropped it. The extremely sudden dimension of the change is conveyed in the space of three short sentences, in fact, from I scream again to my alarm clock is broken. The reader is privileged insofar as the interior monologue provides access to Maud's thoughts and therefore gives the means of understanding what merely appears like disconnected thoughts to others. The reader is, however, also limited by this interior monologue because of Maud's inadequacies as homodiegetic narrator, it is up to the reader to make inferences. The reader is particularly active and solicited as he or she tries to answer Maud's questions to make up for what the narrator does not say or to readjust what she says in order to have a coherent picture of the situation. Sometimes the reader manages to fill in the blanks when Maud describes what she sees without knowing how to interpret or analyze it. For instance, when her semantic memory is going, that is, her memory for words is going, she can't find the word frog. And she merely repeats what the child who's in front of us says, which is fog, and she describes the toy. So it's between fog and the description that the reader infers the right word, but it's never given. Because the reader is given no information other than what Maud is able to give, and is not always, and is thus not always able to fill in the gaps, he or she experiences Maud's disorientation and ensuing frustration. For instance, the source of a roaring noise that puzzles Maud is revealed to the reader at the same time as to Maud, when her daughter Helen explains, there, that's your hoovering done anyway. On top of her inability to interpret or recognize signs that leave blanks in the narration, Maud occasionally directly expresses her experience of blanks when she realizes she has forgotten something. For instance, page 62, somewhere, the other half of the compact hides. In front of me is a hole that I've been digging in the middle of the green garden carpet, and suddenly I can't think what I'm doing here, what it is I'm looking for. So Maud has a blank. As Maud has a blank and loses the thread of her life, the thread of the narrative is interrupted for the reader too, who thus experiences Maud's questioning and frustration. The limits set to the reader by Maud's point of view have an impact on our reading and on our experiencing of Maud's difficulties, but they are also highly significant in terms of plotting. What Maud has forgotten, we, as readers, do not know either. We share her questioning and wondering about Elizabeth's disappearance until Maud reports a conversation with her daughter, whom she does not recognize. And the daughter says, explains at long last, she was in, that's page 251, so towards the end, she was in hospital, mum, a stroke unit, remember? Remember we talked about it again and again and again. The conceit here is the same exactly as in Agatha Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. The narrator has omitted a piece of information, except that Maud is not a murderer and that she is not willfully deceitful but has forgotten the facts. In fact, I'm convinced there's a veiled homage to Christie's novel here in the choice of vegetables to be planted that obsesses Maud. Throughout the novel, she's asking about when to plant, where to plant marrows. And in fact, marrows is the very vegetable that the retired Hercule Poirot attempts to cultivate himself in The Murder of Walter Lacroix. My final questions deals with the issue of closure at the end of the novel. Does the detour by detective fiction and the reference to the historical past of post-war Britain provide the means for a stabilizing closure? First, a remark by Nietzsche Gerard about, she's talking about novels like Healy's and Haddon's. Haddon's is the night of the incident, the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. And she observes the following. These unreliable narrators have the knack of finding out the truth that more rational characters cannot discover. It's an alluring thought that damage can offer enlightenment and that profound loss has a consolation. Like Benji in Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, mad people can see the world in ways that the sane are blind to. They can illuminate the human condition, but advanced dementia thwarts such consolation. Despite her forgetting condition, Maud, in Healy's novel, eventually brings about the solution to the mystery of her sister's death. Okay? So, exactly as mentioned here. The novel, the novel apparently offers reassuring closure of the type often found in classic detective stories. But does Maud's fragmented narrative, due to disorientation and loss of memory, does this fragmented narrative really come together at the end? Is this an empowering narrative like the curious incident? In the end, the 70-year-old mystery of Maud's sister's disappearance is apparently solved as Suki's body is found. Healy's novel thus seems fairly classic. There is a past to be retrieved. There is a clear past to be retrieved as Maud manages to piece it together. When Maud's mind travels back to the period of Suki's disappearance, the narrative evokes the aftermath of World War II. A country with houses in ruins, life with food rationing, and the underground black market. There is little obvious or underlying discourse about the construction of the past or the ideology behind the retelling of the past, as is common in contemporary novels that depict a historical past. Except for the rare commentary offered by Maud's granddaughter. The idea that the present has a limited and normative view of the past is very common, okay, in other contemporary novels. Here it's only suggested when Maud's granddaughter assumes that Maud must like Vera Lynn, who is a famous British wartime singer. Okay, so because it's her period, the granddaughter assumes that her grandmother must like Vera Lynn, which she doesn't. The episode is treated with humor. I mean, there's a hyperbole when the girl addresses her grandmother as, I quote, a traitor to your generation. The episode, however, questions conformist views of the past. The past in the novel finally appears as transient. Remember earlier on I said it seems that there's a clear past that can be retrieved and so on. In fact, it appears as transient as it is based on a fading, receding memory. As her condition deteriorates, Maud finds her childhood memories all jumbled up as we, you know, towards the end of the novel. Coupled with the story of the investigation that revealed Maud as an unlikely solver of mystery, there's also the suggestion that memory cannot be trusted. Also, the linearity of the narrative from mystery to discovery, you know, normally a linear process, this is discreetly challenged too. I said there's a prologue to the novel, and the prologue shows Maud finding the lid of Suki's compact in Elizabeth's garden. You know what a compact is? You know, it's something that they have in movies, you know, something for women to look their faces at, you know, close eyes. So she finds the, she's found the lid in the, and she keeps on, and then she looks for the other half. So she finds the lid in the prologue, she finds the lid in Elizabeth's garden in the presence of her friend. So in a way, the narrative that begins after the prologue is the quest for the other half of the compact. It keeps appearing in the narrative. For instance, chapter 13, she says, I want the thing, the other half of the thing that will lead me to, it's gone. We learn in the last chapter that Elizabeth had a stroke when or after the two old ladies had started digging up the garden. This suggests that Maud had already solved the mystery of Suki's demise before the narrative started, and that the narrative, in fact, tells how she's trying to get back to that point. Moreover, Healy's novel does not pretend that Maud solves the mystery thanks to or despite her memory loss. Really, it's her obsessiveness, which is another symptom of her dementia. It's this obsessiveness which eventually leads her daughter to dig up Elizabeth's garden where she finds Suki's remains. Comforting resolution is no longer a given or a premise in detective fiction. I'm sure you can all think of detective novels that end with the detective failing to find the culprit or to save the abducted child, for instance. The fact that Maud brings about the solution to the mystery of Suki's disappearance is fairly positive and may serve to convey reassurance of some sort, as Nietzsche Gerard, remember, suggested for similar narratives. But Healy's point might be elsewhere. Maud brings about the solution to the mystery, but as I said, only via her daughter Helen. When she, the mystery is solved when Helen listens to her mother's broken tale. So the underlying message here is to, possibly is to address, accept, and respect the patient suffering from AD. Similarly, the occasional use of comedy provides relief and distance in the novel. For instance, when she is tested by the doctor, Maud is taken aback by his questions, and she comments, I quote, I'm beginning to think he's bonkers, and I'm glad Helen is here. Or later when she takes words and phrases at face value. What I'm trying to say here is that we are invited to laugh both with mode and at mode, which actually empowers the character with AED. And this is clearly expressed, I think, when mode says, I can't help smiling. So her granddaughter has just cracked a joke, and she says, I can't help smiling. It's nice being teased. It makes me feel human. At least someone assumes I'm intelligent enough to get a joke. The novel, however, this is early on in the novel, and the novel does not gloss over Maud's predicament, as is visible in the ending. The last words of the novel read, so I must do something. I must, because Elizabeth is missing. These last words obviously send contradictory signals of dynamism and stagnation. The repetition of Elizabeth is missing, the words that are Maud's leitmotif throughout the novel, as well as the title of the novel, these words do not suggest circularity or a real cycle as much as the idea of stagnation, as Maud keeps asking herself the same question. At this point, at the very end, she has solved the mystery, but she does not enjoy the satisfaction of the ending. She is stuck with an idea. The repeated modal form, I must, conveys an endless compulsion and implies no rest in perspective. This obsessive reiteration due to a forgetting state forbids closure for the narrator. The novel may achieve a double closure insofar as both mysteries regarding Elizabeth and Suki are solved, but the satisfaction to be derived is challenged by the fact that the narrator has already forgotten. Which is a way, yes, indicates that the solving of the mystery changes nothing. For Maud, there is no terminal quiescence of the end, which is, you know, when you reach the state when everything is solved, there's nothing more to narrate. Her forgetting state keeps her on tender hooks. It prevents resolution and keeps her in a perpetually puzzling and elusive present. So, to conclude, this paper has examined the workings of the narrative and stylistic strategies used in Elizabeth is Missing, which is a novel about a specific type of forgetting. Like many contemporary novels, it borrows from the genre of detective fiction, especially the classic whodunit, to provide a frame for the idiosyncratic narrator's musings into her past. Contrary to classic texts in which the story of the investigation, that's a quote from Todorov, which I haven't got, so a quick quote, he says, the story of the investigation is a story which has no importance in itself. Okay, what matters is the story of the crime. The story of the investigation serves only as a mediator between the reader and the story of the crime. Here, the story of the investigation is of capital importance as it reveals Maud's particular special unreliability as detective and narrator. Because Maud shares a confused narrative of detection, the reader is doubly forced into action, as he classically shares in the investigating, but also compensates by establishing the missing links and connections from Maud's disorientation while experiencing it at the same time. Closure and disclosure are eventually challenged so as to deepen the reader's apprehension of the condition created by dementia. The novel focuses on the protagonist afflicted with the disease, but it also includes Maud's description of her daughter and granddaughter, her carer, and other people she meets. So it also includes outsiders' reaction to the disease. Healy's novel focuses two different things to conclude, to finish here. One is the emphasis on the affliction, both for Maud and for her family. So, in a way, Elizabeth is Missing can classify as an example of the postmodern, understood as a return to the human, okay? A return to the human, a return to biography, and at the same time, an avoidance of metafictional reflexivity. Okay, we don't have any, it's true, we don't have any of this here. And the other important point to conclude is that in the portrayal of Maud and of her family, the novel shows that if Maud and all the ones she stands for, if Maud is a victim insofar as she's hurt and diminished by the disease, she must not be treated like a victim. And that's it. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup, Armelle, pour cette analyse très, très exhaustive, basée sur des exemples pertinents. Je suis sûr que cette intervention suscite des remarques et des questions de la part de l'auditoire, qui peuvent être formulées en français ou en anglais.
Je peux répéter des choses. Je sais que je suis allée un peu rapidement par moment, donc n'hésitez pas, si vous avez besoin que je répète quelque chose.
Cette notion de unreliable narrators m'a fait penser à un autre best-seller récent, The Girl on the Train.
Ah oui.
Où la protagoniste est alcoolique.
Ouais,
n'est pas en mesure de témoigner exactement de ce qu'elle a vu. Et tout au long du roman, elle essaie de reconstituer comme ça le passé et l'histoire. Et,
ouais.
et je me demandais s'il n'y avait pas une espèce de mode, d'engouement chez les lecteurs pour tous ces narrateurs, tous ces récits où le pris en charge par un personnage peu fiable finalement.
C'est vrai que c'est intéressant pour le lecteur parce que le lecteur est doublement sollicité, doublement actif, donc c'est
ça le rend actif.
Bah voilà. Donc c'est je pense que c'est assez agréable, on ne s'endort pas sur on ne s'endort pas sur le roman pour le coup, je pense. Même si je pense que c'est pas un très bon roman celui-ci de Gogol, donc je l'ai pas aimé du tout moi. Mais. Mais ce qui est intéressant aussi, c'est que c'est aussi un roman policier en quelque sorte. C'est aussi un roman de détection qui a recours à ce genre de choses.
Bah, je pense que effectivement le phénomène s'articule bien avec le genre du polar parce que la vérité, il y a un effet dilatoire, la vérité est révélée à la fin du récit. Et on a juste des bribes de passé comme ça, mais précisément dans la réalité, ça ne se passe pas comme ça pour les malades d'Alzheimer. Ils n'arrivent jamais véritablement à reconstituer le puzzle de leur histoire. Alors est-ce que finalement le thème de la maladie d'Alzheimer n'est pas plus un ressort littéraire, un prétexte peut-être
pour... C'est-à-dire qu'il y a deux choses. Ce que j'essayais de dire, c'est que ça n'est pas elle qui... directement, toute seule, trouve.
Oui.
Tu vois, il y a le cheminement, mais tu as bien on comprend bien qu'elle ne peut pas agir seule, qu'elle a besoin d'une compréhension de l'entourage quand même. Ça, c'est important, je pense. Parce que je pense vraiment qu'il y a un discours sur l'accompagnement, sur le traitement, sur la perception du personnage avec du malade d'Alzheimer. Je pense que ça c'est...
Après, est-ce que les patients en question peuvent entendre et effectivement reconstituer le puzzle? Je ne sais pas.
Non, je ne sais pas. Et alors, il y a donc deux choses que je peux ajouter. C'est que, donc, le roman, hein, je l'ai bien dit, je pense, le roman utilise vraiment les ressorts du roman policier. Toutefois, ça n'est pas du tout. Enfin, à la première lecture, je pense pas du tout qu'on le perçoive comme un roman policier. Ouais, vous avez l'exemplaire britannique là. C'est pas non plus sur le plan marketing. C'est pas non plus du tout présenté comme tel. Et à la lecture, on ne le ressent pas comme un roman policier du tout. Et j'ai voulu voir la traduction française. Et le titre en français, d'ailleurs, ce qui est intéressant, c'est l'oubli. Hein, pour Elizabeth is Missing. En France, on a publié ça dans c'est une maison d'édition qui est spécialisée dans les romans policiers, en fait. Et là, le roman est clairement... Enfin, il y a le mot thriller trois fois sur la quatrième de couverture, vous voyez. Ce qui est assez... Voilà, c'est assez étonnant, mais ça rejoint ce que tu disais, utilisé comme un... Comment dire, comme un ressort. Et la deuxième chose, c'est qu'il y a un autre roman dont je n'ai pas du tout parlé, mais que j'ai mis dans vos bibliographies, je crois. C'est La Plante. Vous devez avoir ça, non?
Oui.
Et ça, c'est un roman américain.
Turn of Mind.
Ouais, Turn of Mind, c'est un roman américain qui est beaucoup plus, dur. La situation, c'est qu'on a aussi on a un personnage avec Alzheimer qui s'exprime à la première, qui s'exprime aussi à la première personne. Là, c'est un peu différent parce que la personne se demande si elle a commis un meurtre ou pas, en fait. Voilà, elle est interrogée, et bon, vous pouvez imaginer ce que ça donne. Et là, c'est vrai que le portrait qui est fait de la malade d'Alzheimer est beaucoup plus dur, je dirais. C'est-à-dire qu'à la fin, je vous ai dit, à la fin de ce roman-ci, ça devient de plus en plus confus, les souvenirs, tout se mélange, les souvenirs, les temps, etc. Mais ça devient complètement... on s'approche du cauchemar à la fin du roman de La Plante, en fait. Hein, donc, c'est un roman, c'est une approche. Évidemment, il y en a plusieurs. Et voilà, le roman de La Plante est intéressant parce que il y a des points communs, mais le traitement final est complètement différent. Mais ce sur quoi je voulais insister, voilà, j'ai utilisé le terme victims, hein, dans le titre. J'en ai pas parlé dans l'introduction, mais je pense que la dimension importante de ce roman, c'est voilà, sur le regard que l'on porte sur les malades d'Alzheimer, la façon dont on peut les traiter, les interpréter, etc.
Oui, je pense pour ce que vient de dire monsieur, sur le malade d'Alzheimer est capable de raisonner. Enfin, ça dépend des étapes, parce qu'il y a une évolution de la maladie qui va de mal en pis. Mais je prends l'exemple. J'ai une sœur aînée qui a une forme de démence, si c'est l'Alzheimer, je ne suis pas sûr, mais... Donc, c'est l'aînée d'une famille, on est cinq enfants. Et quand je suis allé la voir pour la première fois, elle me disait que tous ses frères et sœurs étaient décédés. Alors que le contraire, c'était vrai. Donc, elle avait... je ne sais pas, en regardant la télévision ou l'influence d'un patient qui était dans le même foyer, elle a repris une histoire de fiction. Je lui ai dit non, je suis ton frère, etc. Je lui ai montré des photos, etc. Et puis, elle a dit, mais s'ils sont vivants, pourquoi est-ce qu'ils ne viennent pas me voir? Donc, il y a des raisonnements par moment. Enfin, ça peut passer de la fiction complète à une appréhension de la réalité présente. Donc, il y a quand même des moments de raisonnement, et dans ces moments, il y a une espèce de reconstitution du puzzle.
Voilà, moi je pense que j'ai l'impression qu'il y a sans arrêt du raisonnement, il y a toujours du raisonnement. Simplement, il y a des fois le raisonnement fait sens pour nous, et souvent il ne fait pas sens pour nous. Mais ce que le roman montre bien, et je pense que ça correspond à ce que vous dites, c'est-à-dire que les patients sont sans arrêt en train de réfléchir, d'essayer de comprendre ce qui se passe et d'échafauder des récits, d'échafauder des interprétations.
Mais pendant cette visite, en lui montrant des photos, il a dit le nom d'un de mes frères, d'une de mes sœurs, etc. Momentanément au moins, elle est revenue à une perception de la réalité telle qu'elle existait. Cette capacité qui vient par moment où le malade peut s'apercevoir de la réalité. Mm-hmm. Oui, bon, mm-hmm. c'est...
Donc on pourrait penser que la représentation de la maladie dans ces textes est plutôt fidèle à une réalité observable. Et qu'on n'a pas affaire à une espèce de romanticisation de la maladie.
Je ne pense pas, non, je ne pense pas. Je pense que les romanciers font attention à ça. Mmh. Vraiment. Alors, il y a des moments, dans l'autre dont j'ai parlé au début, là, Stella Alessa. Bon, ça, c'est un roman. C'est un roman, c'est un objet littéraire, vraiment. Stella Alessa, peut-être un peu moins. Hein. Mmh. Et donc, par moments, ça dérive, ça devient un peu mièvre, peut-être, mais c'est pas le but du jeu, et c'est vraiment pas l'effet escompté. Et d'ailleurs, je trouve ça très. Moi, ce que je trouve intéressant aussi, c'est par rapport au roman, par rapport à ce que fait le roman aujourd'hui, hein, que les romanciers aient à nouveau à cœur de décrire des situations. Humaine, complexe, enfin, on se croit au 19e, là, je trouve, hein, dans le désir de réalisme en quelque sorte, hein, de décrire le réel, de décrire les sentiments de l'humain, les difficultés. On est loin d'un exercice de style, hein, ce que le roman a pu faire pendant plusieurs. Certains romans plus expérimentaux ou appelés expérimentaux. Ont beaucoup fait au XXe siècle. Hein.
Et le cancer n'a sans doute pas la même attractivité pour les écrivains.
Je ne me suis pas penchée sur le...
Peut-être parce que justement, ce n'est pas une question de reconstitution du passé, ça ne touche pas le cerveau forcément. Je ne sais pas.
Non, là, je n'ai pas lu du tout ça, je ne sais pas.
Je n'ai pas l'impression. Ouais. Peut-être que je me trompe. Merci pour votre témoignage, en tout cas. Des questions, des remarques? N'hésitez pas à intervenir s'il y a des éléments qui sont peu clairs, par exemple dans la théorie
le post-moderne.
Oui, c'est vilain, mais en même temps c'est...
Du coup, là, à l'occasion d'une perte de mémoire, à l'occasion d'une incapacité à vraiment redonner les faits comme tels, est-ce que c'est pas le cas quand même assez fréquemment des narrateurs internes, spécifiquement dans les romans? Bon, après, dans mon cas, les romans de fantasy spécifiquement, mais dans les romans, on voit quand même assez souvent des narrateurs qui vont changer les faits pour peut-être embellir la situation ou plutôt se donner un air, et après on va apprendre peut-être une véritable version par un autre personnage qui va le corriger ou quelque chose comme ça. Mais dans tous les cas, l'idée d'un narrateur qui n'est pas fiable, c'est quand même quelque chose qui revient hors du monde de la part de mémoire.
Ah oui, oui, absolument. C'est ce que je vous disais. C'est un type qui s'est beaucoup développé, effectivement, au cours du 20e en prenant et du 21e en prenant différents aspects, différentes représentations. Mais oui, absolument. C'est assez courant. C'est pas systématique, mais c'est assez fréquent.
Est-ce qu'il y a, une romancière anglaise qui avait la maladie d'Alzheimer?
Cyrus Murdoch.
Oui, c'est ça, oui. Qui est venu faire des conférences à cette université. Et c'est son mari qui a écrit l'histoire de sa maladie. Je ne sais pas si... Je ne vois pas parmi les exemples.
Pas, non,
vous,
non.
Vous ne vous êtes pas penché sur...
Non, parce que c'est un témoignage. Vous voyez, c'est un témoignage. Moi, je m'occupe... Et là, ce qui m'intéresse, c'est vraiment la fiction. C'est la représentation dans la fiction. Mais... non, voilà, oui, oui. Non, j'ai connaissance du texte, mais effectivement, je ne l'ai pas...
Stanton indique que c'est le miroir du réel, donc... Et comparer le réel et le fictif, ça pourrait être intéressant aussi.
Ça a été... le film, je crois, c'est directement construit à partir du... je crois qu'il est construit à partir du témoignage de John Bailey, il doit s'appeler, hein, c'est
John
ça
John Bailey, voilà. Mais j'ai écouté des conférences de Iris Murdoch à l'université de Caen.
Ça devait être... c'était autre chose.
Et l'empathie, est-ce que tu pourrais dire quelques mots de l'empathie? Parce que c'est toujours un concept un petit peu discutable. Empathie entre qui et qui? Est-ce que l'émotion est plus forte quand des thèmes comme ceux-là sont abordés?
Alors oui, l'empathie narrative, alors, je ne sais plus si je l'ai mis dedans, c'est Keane qui a écrit sur le sujet, Susan Keane, sur l'empathie narrative. Et c'est vrai que c'est très difficile, c'est un terme très... difficile à manier dans la mesure où on a du mal à la cerner. Elle a écrit un livre entier on pourra en écrire un autre pour contester ce qu'elle dit. Elle contredit, je vous ai cité Lodge là tout à l'heure, qui dit que les romans à la première personne établissent un lien plus proche avec le tente. C'est artificiel, mais établissent un lien plus proche avec le lecteur. Elle pense que ça n'est absolument pas justifié, par exemple. Elle pense qu'on peut avoir tout à fait la même chose avec un récit à la troisième personne. Mais ce qui est intéressant, je trouve, c'est que c'est un concept, encore une fois, qui revient. Tu vois, c'est avec cette notion de post-postmodernisme, de retour, d'à nouveau se focaliser sur le personnage comme représentation d'une réalité humaine, psychologique. C'est intéressant comme concept qui revient. C'est vrai que pendant un moment, l'empathie aurait été considéré complètement inutilisable comme terme, parce que ça implique identification. Ça implique l'identification au personnage. Or, les personnages sont des êtres de papier que l'on doit bien distinguer des autres. Donc tout ça participe d'un retour. Et encore, j'aime pas le mot retour, parce qu'on a l'impression d'un pas en arrière. Alors je pense pas que ce soit ça non plus, mais d'une nouvelle prépondérance accordée à l'humain, à la fois dans la représentation, dans la représentation et donc dans la perception, la lecture.
avec ce post-modernisme, ce repositionnement par rapport à l'humain, l'empathie, avec les neurosciences et les nouvelles théories sur la lecture empathique, justement. Est-ce qu'il y a un lien à faire avec ça?
Là, je ne sais pas, j'avoue, je...
Non,
je ne sais pas.
J'ai trouvé vachement intéressant la façon dont tu utilises le roman de policier et je me disais que, dans un sens, l'utilisation d'Alzheimer, là, ça pallie un peu à un défaut du genre qui est le secret, qui au final est un peu construit, puisqu'au final, toute l'enquête, comme tu dis, elle est un peu secondaire, la structure, etc. Et là, en fait, le secret est... Il n'y en a même pas vraiment.
Exactement.
Parce que c'est le contact qu'elle a trouvé, mais que nous, on ne sait pas qu'elle a trouvé. Donc, le secret, c'est juste cette oubli et cette ignorance. Du coup, je trouve que c'était intéressant la réflexion que tu menais sur l'évolution aussi du genre policier, la manière dont on peut moduler ce genre et essayer de pallier ces défauts.
Ouais, merci. C'est vrai que. Je vous disais, moi je le perçois pas a priori premièrement comme un roman policier parce que voilà, je pense que ça n'en est pas un. Comme tu le rappelais, à la limite, Elizabeth is missing, en tant que lecteur, la personne est âgée, on a très vite une bonne idée de ce qui a pu lui arriver. Hein, bon, ce qui moins, mais donc il y a un mystère, mais qui quelque part n'en est pas un. C'est pas ça qui nous invite à continuer à lire. Et c'est vrai que je suis pas spécialiste hein, du roman policier parce que je ne peux pas parce que je trouve ça je trouve que c'est très personnel hein, ce que je dis là, mais le problème du roman policier à mon avis, c'est que on a un format, on a un schéma à suivre, et par conséquent, les personnages ne sont que des agents, que des pièces en fait dans le schéma qui doit aller du début à la fin, d'accord. Et en tant que lectrice, moi personnellement, j'ai une frustration avec le roman policier parce que voilà, j'ai l'impression d'avoir des pions dans le roman au lieu d'avoir des personnages. Et selon moi, les meilleurs romans policiers sont ceux qui sont écrits par des romanciers standard entre guillemets qui s'essayent au roman policier et qui vont donc avoir on va aboutir à un roman hybride en fait qui emploie hein, qui utilise, mais il y a beaucoup de romans contemporains qui font ça, qui utilisent les techniques du roman policier mais sans en être hein. Et oui voilà donc
ce que tu disais sur la fin, le fait qu'il y ait à la fois une fermeture et à la fois un refus, ça montre aussi cette construction du roman policier qui construit une fin mais qui est juste construite. Et là, du coup, ça montre la construction de la fin, ce que tu disais par rapport à Suki. Et je pense que la dernière phrase, Elizabeth Smith, montre bien que c'est juste une construction et qu'en fait.
Complètement, oui.
Ouais. Ça continue dans cette.
Complètement. Ouais. On a une conclusion et en même temps, on montre bien que voilà, qu'elle est complètement fabriquée, qu'elle est complètement artificielle. Ouais.
Je pense qu'aujourd'hui, c'est difficile de faire entrer les textes dans des catégories bien précises du point de vue du genre.
De plus en plus,
de toute façon, l'hybridité est quand même caractéristique. Ouais. Et un des premiers à avoir réutiliser les techniques du polar comme ça, avec d'autres éléments, c'est Umberto Eco, avec Le nom de la rose.
Oui, tout à fait. Ben, Barriott, là, dont on parlait très rapidement, et dont j'ai parlé un peu ce matin à certains d'entre vous, son roman Possession, justement, est inspiré, enfin, elle l'a écrit en pensant au nom de la rose, et c'est un roman qui, lui aussi, utilise les ressorts du roman policier, effectivement. Et ce roman-là, il date de 1990, donc effectivement, ça fait un moment que que l'hybridité règne, je dirais.
D'autres remarques?
Je vais essayer de formuler le mieux possible que ce que vous disiez sur l'intérêt des auteurs pour le cancer, est-ce que c'était égal ou pas à la maladie d'Alzheimer, l'exemple qui me vient à l'esprit, qui est peut-être le plus connu de notre génération et le plus récent, c'était Nos étoiles contraires.
Ah oui.
Et du coup, je trouvais que l'intérêt est peut-être pas dans la narration et dans le point de vue du personnage, mais ça me fait penser par exemple à ce que vous disiez sur Atonement. Et donc cette histoire de... Enfin, cette notion de temps limité avant de pouvoir réaliser quelque chose. Donc peut-être que l'intérêt est là plutôt dans la notion de temps limité. Mm. Donc dans Atonement, elle essaye de justement...
Ça l'oblige à mettre un terme. Ça l'oblige à...
Ouais. Avant de perdre tout, hein, de perdre sa mémoire. Et dans le cas de Nos étoiles contraires, avant de perdre la vie, de pouvoir faire un maximum de choses.
Mmh. Je n'ai pas lu celui-ci. Mon fils est en train de le lire en ce moment, mais moi je l'ai pas. Mais voilà, je sais de quoi il parle, mais je l'ai pas lu.
On va inviter ton fils au prochain séminaire.
Bah voilà, ouais. Mais je crois qu'il est en train de caler en fait sur le. Je crois qu'il a pas fini de le lire justement. Il me disait, oh, bah, c'est un peu, c'est spécial quand même. Oui.
D'autres remarques, réactions, questions?
Il y a peut-être des comparaisons possibles avec la littérature des films sur l'amnésie. En fait, oui, moi je pense à une comédie de Laurel et Hardy qui se passe à Oxford. Et puis c'est Laurel qui reçoit une fenêtre. Il tombe sur sa tête et puis il devient amnésique et puis à la fin il a un autre coup de la tête et puis il retrouve sa mémoire. Mais bon, c'est un peu, c'est très caricatural, mais ça a donné lieu à, je pense, toute une littérature sur l'amnésie qui peuvent être... des comédies des drames, des tragédies également.
Oui. Pensez par rapport au cinéma, je pense que le... Est-ce que quelqu'un a vu Mr. Holmes? Tu l'as vu? Oui, c'est ça. Parce que moi, je ne l'ai pas... Justement, je voulais le voir, mais j'ai pas réussi à le voir. Mais c'est cette idée-là aussi, ça joue. Oui. C'est ça, Holmes est en fin de...
Et en même temps, il essaye de se rappeler un cas qui est
voilà, ouais. Bon,
et à la fin, comme là, il retrouve la solution de l'enquête, mais c'est pas. Il est quand même frustré parce que il commence à oublier tout ce qui se passe à ce moment-là. J'ai trouvé que le film était assez poignant dans la représentation. Il y a une McKellen qui est très affaiblie, du coup. Et en contraste, il est avec un jeune garçon à qui il apprend à devenir un caisson.
Donc, si tu, il, là aussi, il trouve. Il a la solution. Ouais. Mais effectivement, enfin, moi, ça m'a posé question, la remarque de Nietzsche Jared, là, en disant, bon, tous ces romans, finalement, font un portrait relativement positif, parce que peut-être que nous, en tant que lecteurs, on a besoin de ça. Je pense que c'est aussi, à titre anecdotique, elle dédie le roman à ses deux grands-mères. Hein, bon, il y a fort à penser qu'il y en a une au moins qui a eu cette maladie. Et donc, ce que j'essayais de dire, c'est que à mon avis, il y a vraiment un désir de pas tant de témoigner entre guillemets, mais surtout de modifier le regard que l'on peut avoir sur les malades et d'insister sur la notion de personne. La notion de personne qui doit être respectée même si les choses semblent être en dépit du bon sens pour nous. Je pense que c'est vraiment le discours latent.
Ok. Tu n'as pas essayé de le dire, tu l'as très bien. Merci encore, Armelle, pour cette intervention passionnante. Merci à vous pour votre présence. On se reverra dans le cadre de ce séminaire le 22 mars, dans cette salle à 15h. Gilles Couder fera une intervention sur le musicien et compositeur britannique Benjamin Britten, sur le War Requiem de Benjamin Britten.